Don't be stupid about it by always throwing them into the meeting and nobody knows what they mean. So now they don't only figure you don't speak simple English, you don't speak English. Throw them out and then say, well, what? Let me translate that for you. Say, oops, sorry I slipped into jargon. In our profession, what this means is, and by the way, let me just show you the theory while we're at it here. You got 25 minutes? Jargon is absolutely critical to show that you are different. Now, when we deal with publics out there, of course we put it down into English. But if you don't think jargon is important, then just go to the phone and call your stockbroker. Okay? Call your lawyer, go to visit your doctor, talk to the contractor working on your house, or even the damn plumber. And they have got jargon down pat. They know, here's what the psychological effect of jargon is. Jargon says, I am different than you. I know some things that you don't know, but I'm a nice person. I'm willing to not only share what I know with you, but I'm also willing even to tell you the terms I use to designate what I know. And the true test is at the next meeting when the super uses the jargon and looks over at you and says, did I get that right, Sally? You say, yeah, that's right. That's right, super. You got it down pat. Don't overlook the importance of this. Don't be stupid about it. Always explain it. Don't use it as an I know something you don't know. But for God's sake, stop speaking simple English. They'll think you are simple. And that's the problem, isn't it, that we're trying to overcome. How about doing this? Stop, underline, circulating clippings. Please don't send any more clippings around saying, look what I got in the paper. Instead, let somebody else do that, because you may want to get them around. There may be information that people should know. Instead, clip articles about trends, about demographics, about new behavioral patterns, about what we're finding from the behavioral sciences or managerial theories, and circulate those. Because you see, if you just circulate your clips or your latest newsletter or your latest focus group or whatever you're doing, even at the high strategic level, they expect that. So sure, you got to do that. That's course of business. But to position yourself, circulate things that they might not expect from you. Force them to think. And now you've positioned yourself again as a person that is strategic, that is broad. Simplest thing in the world. In fact, I have to admit that I'm very forgetful and lazy, and I get very methodical about it, and I just make a list of who are the opinion leaders in my organization that I really want to have convinced, and I just make a little list, and I decide how many things a year I'm going to send them, and if something doesn't come up naturally, comes March 1st, and on my calendar it says, this month, send something to Harry, Susie, and Mary. And that month I will find something, because I can't close the month until I've checked off all the little things in my do list and I send them something. Be that way about it if you have to. The point is, get the stuff circulating. How about your public visibility in non-school activities? Are you pretty good at that? A lot of school public relations people are really expert at this. But a lot of us are awfully busy and we've kind of lost that touch. I think it goes with the job, because it's joining those other organizations where you really find out what people think about the schools and where you make the networks and all of that. Well, if you're going to bother being visible in those other organizations, make sure everybody back home knows it. I don't care if you go around merely and circulate funds for the bake sale. It's you showing up for another organization, demonstrating by being there that you see more than just the inside of school administration offices, that you are a public personage. And then, if you can become an officer, a speaker, an important person in those outside organizations, oftentimes that's what lets you become a more important personage inside. And the way you know you're starting to be effective is when the naysayers inside the organization start criticizing you for spending too much time outside. I'm serious. That I have found is the visible resistance. They notice that you're doing something they probably aren't doing. Now, if you were an accountant, they might be able to criticize you for anything you did that wasn't, after 5 and before 8, or after 8 and before 5, probably more like it, but not in public relations. You see, we can justify anything we do like that because it's part of our job, okay? So that's one you can really make hit home, and it can be very, very important. Do you have an annual report? If you don't have an annual report that's circulated, you fight to get to do the annual report that's just filed. I don't care, but every organization needs an annual stock taking. The best way to do it is in an annual report. Most school districts now, probably most of you, are doing them and actually circulating them to the public. But make sure you do it. Now, they might ask you to do it because you're the communicator, but that's not what I mean. I don't mean you design it and all of that and edit their copy. I mean, you fight to make it your project every year, because notice what you are doing. You are now evaluating the management. And if you can't use that little tool, not to print things, you know, that are going to get your head cut off, that isn't effective, but to enter discussions during the putting together of the report that raise the issues you want raised, that hear the comments that should be heard, that get the discussions going that are necessary for progress. And you see, what I'm looking for always here is something that is legitimized. Not you out there just shooting in and people can say, mind your own business, but instead you coming in legitimately, having been asked, having been assigned to do it. That clearly is a far quicker way to get to do the things that you want to do. Finally, I'll give you a few more things, and then I give you some time for questions, and I guess our time is kind of running out. Do you know your boss's, I'm not going to write up here anymore, my arm is tired. Do you know your boss's style of management? Have you analyzed your boss's style? You ought to do it. Is this a task-oriented kind of person that thinks human nature and human beings don't matter, just do what you're told? Is this a person that understands socio-technical systems, that knows that all task technical organizations really are the product of a society, of a culture? Whatever it is, find out your boss's managerial style. And then, whether you like it or not, learn to play within that style. Now, changing the style, maybe one of the major public relations and particularly internal relations goals that you have. But the funny thing is that you can't change them by shooting at them. First, you got to get inside them. And then you can say, hey, you know, you and I believe in this approach. I wonder if this is working. Could we be wrong? Should we consider something else? Whereas, you see, if you've been a critic of that style and you say that, he'll say, oh, I know, you never did trust this. You never did like that, and it merely builds a resistance. But if we don't know managers' styles, and oh my Lord, do they have styles. I won't go into it. There are a number of long treatises on the 6 or 8 recognizable managerial styles. If you don't have one of those, get one. Peg your colleagues on it and try and work with them within their style, if nothing else, than to change it to a better style. How does your boss prefer to get information? An awful lot of people in our field use our communication skills really to beat up on people. If they don't like memos, man, we drown them in memos. I'm going to get even with you. I'm going to send you memos. Find out how your boss wants to be communicated with, and then do it that way. Now, that doesn't mean if he or she is one that always wants just a quiet chat, that you don't have to put some things on paper. But at least do it in the chat first, and then send the paper for the files or for the official record or whatever. But it's amazing how often we don't even know whether bosses are listeners or readers. When you get to be my age, there's a certain crisis that occurs, and the young people in our firm have alerted me to this in clients. And that is that after the age of 40, as you probably know, something happens to the muscles of the eyes, and you have to wear these stupid things. And I start to notice when I really study it that clients suddenly about that age prefer to have meetings. They don't want the long report, particularly when they've just gotten it. Well, I mean, you know, are we sensitive to that? These are human beings we're dealing with. If they've got a sore foot, For God's sake, don't step on their toe. That's all I'm saying. But we need to be sensitive to some of those things. Does your boss like to be involved in the routine or like to delegate? Because if they don't want to be involved in the routine, bless them for it. Make reports and practice what may be the most important rule of all. I'm going to write it up big, right up here on top, because it combines much of what we've been talking about. Practice, I think I misspelled that. Practice vacuum management. You know what vacuum management is? If there's a vacuum, you fill it. If you've got a boss that is willing to let you just do your own thing, then you grab it. You fill that vacuum. You get it done. Don't wait to be asked. Take the risk. And until someone says stop, just keep doing it. And oftentimes you can pick up the best pieces of turf just by filling the vacuum. And when you're told to stop, of course you say, oh gosh, you know, it's kind of the Ollie North syndrome, Ron. He never told me to stop. Well, think about it for a minute. As threatening as his activities happen to be to the whole democratic governance of our society, most Americans apparently think he's some kind of hero. So maybe the same thing will work for you, and hopefully you'll be doing things that are far more obviously helpful to the organization rather than starting your own CIA. So how about the opinion leaders inside your organization? You all know I'm on a kick to get us to list the opinion leaders in our key outside publics. How about the key opinion leaders in your management? If they're all sitting around the table, who moves the decisions? Now, you know that. You can observe it. Well, aren't those the people to focus on? Really focus on those people who move the decision. Get to know those people. Get to know their goals. All the things we've said here. And when you've got an idea that you want to sell, deal with them in advance, one-on-one of the meeting. In fact, a good technique before a critical meeting, if you've got a particular program you want to sell, is to talk to everyone who's going to be in the meeting, one-on-one, in advance, so that when you go to the meeting, you already know where people are coming from. And if it looks like the vote is going to be 6-4 against you, postpone the meeting and get to those swing votes. So it's going to be 6-4 for you. Then you quickly call the meeting. Oh, listen, standard managerial technique, standard. I think we are so pure in school public relations that we forget that these are busy, fearful, harassed human beings that are asking us for leadership in a very specific, critical area, and yet often fearful of really letting us take it. And so I think using techniques, as long as they're open and ethical, is something we just have to do. You cannot leave it to chance. And those opinion leaders in your organization, by the way, let's sell them on the big philosophy of public relationships. Take them to lunch. Put them on your plan as a target public and really work on them. Now you say, well, wait, they're not paying me for that. I'm supposed to be talking to business people in the community and parents. Listen. You can talk to those people till hell freezes over. And if you can't get the administration to move in the right direction, will it matter? It will not matter. So let us remember that. Because short of quitting and starting a revolution with those external publics back against the management, which I know is a good idea, and if you want to do it and if you can raise any money, call me. But if you can't, stay inside and sell them on the philosophy. Well, I could obviously talk a lot of things. I could talk about the fact that when you have a problem inside your organization, try contract management. You know what contract management is? Some of you have probably heard me tell that my last teenager, who was one of those totally unhandleable cases, I finally, at the age of 13, started doing contract management with her. And every year we would sit down and write a contract. This is what I'm going to do. This is what you're going to do. Now, the purpose of that wasn't to be able to say, you violated the contract. That's not what contract management is. You sit down and you contract where you both stand. You openly admit the disagreement. But you do it now inside socially acceptable ways. And you've got it down there. And you both say what you're going to do. And then if there's a failure, you don't get mad at each other. You don't say, you say that damn contract. We didn't write the contract broad enough, or we left that out of the contract. So that the focus is on that piece of paper, and it enables two people then to really work together. I mean, it worked great on my 13-year-old, you know. Rock music only between the hours of 11:30 and midnight. You know, little deals like that. The car on certain hours, all of those things. And literally, we would rewrite the contract, you know, probably monthly during the year, and then we'd have an annual contract renewal. But it kept us in communication when we otherwise might not have been. And it kept the judgmentalism out of it. We spent a lot of time cussing the contract, but we weren't cussing each other nearly as much. Try it if you have a situation. There's a lot written about that, and you can get some more. Finally, let me talk a little bit about your role as a consultant in the organization, because I think this is critical. As many of you know, there are three kinds of consultants. There are expert consultants. There are consultants who are really an extension of the management. And then there are collaborative consultants. Now, anybody that has a professional skill, who has positioned themselves as we've been talking about, might as well think of themselves as a counselor, because you are. I mean, the lawyer, the curriculum specialist, the buildings and grounds experts, the auditors, they have technical skills that others don't have. And so much of the time, their role, in addition to contributing to general decision making, is to be asked to deal from their point of expertise. And so you've got to consider yourself a counselor within the organization. The question is, which kind of counselor is effective? Now, this does depend to some extent on the management style of the people involved, but by and large, an expert consultant is a very dangerous role, because an expert is someone you turn to for the solution. And so if you allow your fellow managers the luxury of turning to you for solutions, every time you do that, you're walking the plank. Because you see, it's your solution. And that doesn't work. We need to have collaborative solutions so that other managers have ownership of it and they will get behind it. Otherwise, they're glad to sit back in their chair, let you do your thing, and when you fail, say, well, I was pretty sure it wouldn't work anyway. So being an expert is dangerous. Being an extension of management is the absolute pits, because that means you're just running around striking fear and terror into teachers and staff and principals on behalf of the management. But collaborative consultants, people who understand that you do not give answers, you only give options. So that when you are asked, wow, how are we going to deal with this teacher's strike? Don't say, well, here's my plan, 1, 2, 3. Say, well, gather round, everybody. It looks to me like we've got 3 options, and here they are. And then you retire to the corner and let them decide. Because when they've decided, it's their plan. Now, they probably didn't think of any of those options or in the way that you presented them until you showed up. But when all is said and done, the assignments you and others get out of that will at least have the support of the team. Otherwise, you'll be shoved out front to take the bullets, and you know, they will find your body by the wall when the assault is over, and the rest of them are inside drinking margaritas. Never forget that. If you have any problems with this as a technique for positioning yourself and for really getting the confidence, and I can understand how you would, because you say, Jackson comes and he tells us, get their confidence, and then when they ask me for an opinion, I give them 2 to choose from. Well, just think for a minute. Just think for a minute about the psychology of all of this. If you know anything about psychological consulting, about dealing with people, you know that psychotherapists never tell their patients. They always draw the answer out of the patient. Because then the patient has ownership. The patient is committed to it. The patient says, you know, I'm going to do this. And when the patient comes back, the doctor doesn't say, I told you to do that. You didn't do it. The doctor says, gee, you know, you weren't able to keep it up. Let's talk on, do you really want to do it? And all of those things. You're all familiar with this. We are not medical doctors. Medical doctors come from a special expertise and from a background of telling us what to do. Take six pills. We're not medical doctors. Don't be a medical doctor. Be a psychotherapist that says, well, what outcomes do you really want here? What are we really after? What are the options of how we get there and get joint decisions? Just think about that analogy, and I think you'll see the wisdom of it. Well, I got a lot more stuff here, but I think time is running out. Let me just make one final point. Literally, there's enough of this material, good counseling material. Well, we do two-day seminars for clients on consulting skills, on how to counsel clients and be accepted as a peer and so forth. That's how much material there is, and believe me, we've already cut that in tenths, probably, of what's available. So get some of this material for yourself. But the one thing that often people say to me afterwards is they say, wow, this isn't easy. I have to work at this, just like my job. Well, that's right. When you go to see your lawyer, doctor, engineer, architect, whomever, they have to work at dealing with your needs. Why should it be easy for us? All of those people first have to deal with us as humans, with the environment that we are acting in, the networking, the outside influences, and only then can they get down to the subject matter. If we think it's easy and that this sort of thing I'm talking about we just do on the side, I think we've missed the whole point. The point isn't getting a damn newsletter out. The point is having a superintendent and a board that understand public relationships, that understand who owns the schools, that understand nonetheless how to deal with idiotic ideas that come in from outside without turning everybody upside down and backwards, unless it's certain groups, and that's okay. It's a bigger task than the details, and so we cannot expect it to be easy. And finally, I have to make my perpetual plea that despite all I've said here about techniques, about science, if you will, remember, none of this works without judgment. You got to apply some judgment. Don't ever worry about technology, whether it be computers or anything else, driving us out. All technology can do is play, pander, if you will, to our natural laziness, so things get done more quickly, more easily. Because when all is said and done, when I look at what I do for a client, for example, if I can give that client the benefit of some judgment that puts things in the right direction, frankly, it doesn't matter if I fail at almost everything else. Because an organization going in the right direction, a person, yourself, going in the right direction is the most powerful tool we have. And at the risk of boring some of you who may have heard it before, just let me close by giving you an illustration of judgment that I hope you will remember, as well as this small beginning list of techniques that I've suggested we can use to get confidence. At Oxford University in England, you probably know that the senior professors there are called dons. The dons at Oxford are an interesting group. Of course, the other thing besides interesting dons at Oxford is the sport of the university, which is called punting on the Thames. You probably know the Thames River flows through the Oxford campus. It's just a narrow, shallow little thing there. And punts are shallow bottom, flat bottom boats, and you take a long pole, and it's kind of like being a gondolier in Venice. You punt down the Thames. Well, the dons at Oxford liked the Thames a lot. And after the Second World War, they did something that no one to this day has been able to figure out. They formed a nude bathing club on the shores of the Thames. It's called the Preserve. Now, of course, immediately after the war, all the dons were male, and so this male nude bathing club caused problems for people punting on the Thames. So the deal was that when the dons were in the preserve, they would tie a bandana around a certain tree, and any women that happened to be punting would then politely stop at the tree. Well, it's a different world, isn't it? And a lot of the dons at Oxford now are themselves female. And the story is told that a few years ago, some of them were out punting and they saw their bandana, and in characteristic fashion, they said, "The hell with it." And on down the stream they went. Well, lo and behold, here are all these white walruses bathing in the Thames. And here comes this punt full of women. The best illustration of judgment I know is the response of those gentlemen. Most of them did the perfectly typical natural thing. They took their hands and they went like that. But one very wise senior don with great judgment, he didn't do that. He took his hands and he went like that. And after the danger had passed, the walruses said to him, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I don't know about you gentlemen, but around town I am known by my face." Questions? Anybody for questions? Everybody for lunch? Nobody for questions? Thanks for listening. See you later.
That concludes this session.